Hello and welcome to the Sense of Place podcast. Now in today's episode, I have a chat with street art expert, Chris Penza. Chris is the founder of the House of Graffiti, which works with street artists to design and execute bespoke murals for private and commercial clients. Chris also does street art walking tours, and he has an Instagram, which is home to his hashtag Street Art on Skates, which was a lockdown passion project of his, where he shares his thoughts on street art as he skates around London. Now, before we get into today's episode, I'll give you the rundown of some of the things we discuss. Firstly, what is street art and graffiti, and an overview of its origins. When and how did it become mainstream? How Chris got interested in street art and graffiti, and how he established the House of Graffiti and also his event business, which is called Penza Events. The different motivations to create for artists and writers. And then finally, we discuss some of our favourite street artists and their processes. So for this episode over on Patreon, I've put together some images and further information about the artists and writers we discuss in this episode. It was actually really fun putting it together. As Chris mentioned, some artists when we were talking that I wasn't aware of. So it was really fun to look further into their work and their backgrounds. So if you're a patron and you are able to listen and follow along with those images or even just have a look after the episode, I'd recommend it. Another thing for patrons, I've now put all the episode extras under a tab on there called Collections, so it will have any episode extras that I've done in the past plus this one all in one place, because obviously on there you can be scrolling and scrolling with so many posts, so it just keeps things a bit more neat and tidy. And if you're somebody that's just found the podcast and listening to past episodes, then you will find them all under one place under the Collections tab, and it is titled Episode Extras. So Chris has a wealth of knowledge and he's clearly really passionate about the subject, so it was really great to have a chat with him. After our call, we actually did talk about doing round two at some point, because there's so much to explore in the world of street art and graffiti. And one last thing before we get into today's episode, I did just refer to artists and writers, as does Chris in the episode, and I'm probably teaching you to suck, Ed, so sorry here, but just for clarification, writer tends to refer to someone who is more interested in spraying a graffiti tag, so writing their name wherever and whenever they get the chance for a thrill tends to be a bit more illegal and underground, whereas artists, well, obviously, they create beautiful pieces of art with meaning behind them, for people to see all over the streets. Anyway, we'll crack on with the episode now, and I really hope you enjoy it. Chris, obviously you are an art historian, street art expert, founder of House of Graffiti, and I do want to get into your background and passion for that subject, but I think a good point to start would be with the foundations of our conversation, street art.
Yep.
So, you know, what is that? Because there might be some listeners thinking all it amounts to, you know, is spraying a graffiti tag on a bridge, train carriage, vandalism, but obviously it's so much more than that. Would you be able to sort of tell us a bit about its evolution and history, and, you know, what street art is?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'll do my best to kind of cover as much of it as I know. I don't know everything, but that's a question that could go on and on and on, really, because I think that, I mean, the easiest way to describe it is when I, you know, walk people through the streets of Shoreditch or wherever I'm walking, I always find that at the end of the 2 hours or 2.5 hours we spend together, their perception of what street art and graffiti is a million miles away from what they probably thought at the beginning of, you know, the walk. So like you say, I mean, graffiti and street art, you know, they're different things. They relate to each other. We can talk about that. But in terms of the sort of styles and media that, you know, artists certainly today are using, it ranges from, obviously, from spray paint, but you've got stencils, you've got sculpture, you've got, there are really interesting artists working with like relief sculpture, mosaics, tiles, you know, there's artists working with thread. There's a whole community of artists who identify as paste up or poster artists. You know, there are yarn bombers. There's an amazing artist called Ben Wilson who paints little kind of like micro miniature pictures on little bits of chewing gum that have been stuck to the street. And, you know, they're really hard and rare to find, you know, in the wild. So if you spot one, it's a really amazing thing. There are artists, you know, who kind of have all sorts of styles, like calligraffiti, for example, which is a sort of hybrid calligraphy and graffiti, you know, all sorts of things. So we absolutely don't just talk about murals made with spray cans. We're sort of constantly ducking down little side alleys, talking about, you know, a random little poster or a sticker, even something that's interesting. So there is no one size fits all style or medium for street art and graffiti. But I mean, in terms of the origins, I suppose, of graffiti, because graffiti obviously predates street art. Street art's a relatively new term and carries with it quite a lot of cultural baggage, I suppose. You know, there are a lot of graffiti writers out there, for example, who think that street artists are, you know, they represent the sort of gentrification, I suppose, of urban culture versus what they would perceive to be the sort of raw roots of it, which relate, you know, I suppose, in essence, back to the golden age of graffiti as we probably think about it, which is sort of New York in the 70s and 80s. But actually, even graffiti in those terms slightly predates that. I mean, you know, there's a movement in Philadelphia, actually, which kind of predates the New York scene. And there's, you know, real kind of graffiti experts kind of argue about where it was born, I suppose, because yeah, obviously everyone wants to be the kind of, I suppose, be the first place to sort of invent this style. But most conventional wisdom suggests that both of those movements, you know, came up at a similar kind of time. But I mean, I'm interested in the sort of the roots of humans making marks on walls, you know, self-expression. I mean, the Greeks and the Romans, and if you think about Egyptian hieroglyphs, you know, these are humans making and communicating marks on walls. And I think, you know, cave paintings, for example, like I think the earliest known cave painting is something like 62,000 years old. I think it was found in a cave in Spain. And interestingly, I think, although I'm sure someone will correct me, but I think that was a stencil, actually, of a human hand. So it's sort of an imprint, if you like, of a human hand on a wall, which it's probably a little bit of a leap, but I really like that idea that sort of stenciling as we know it today, you know, possibly relates to a very early ancestor 62,000 years ago, who was also kind of like interested in the mark that his hand left on the cave wall, you know. So all of that stuff really interests me. And so, you know, that's a very potted history of, you know, graffiti and street art from my perspective. But we can delve into anything that has sort of piqued your interest there.
Yeah, no, I'm quite interested in sort of the perception of it, how it's changed, because obviously, like you say, graffiti's been a thing since not the beginning of time, but, you know, thousands of years. But then it did have sort of a negative connotation with it. I almost feel like now as well with street art, these murals and, like you say, other forms, it seems to have more of a positive view. I mean, when do you think that was? When do you think people started to see it more as art? Because for me, it feels like it's not been that long, really, that it's become a thing. You know, people get hired to do murals and things now, like it's actually seen as a proper form of art.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the appreciation probably in the mainstream, which again is something that graffiti writers and street artists, you know, have by nature avoided the mainstream. They've always existed as a subculture or as an underground movement, which is part of the beauty of it. And it's what interested me, I think, the fact that there was this sort of underground, slightly, you know, mysterious community of artists who were, you know, choosing the streets as their sort of mode of self-expression. But probably, I mean, definitely in my lifetime, you know, I'm 43 and I've been really involved in the street art scene probably for 20-ish years. So yeah, I think when I, you know, my entry point to street art and graffiti was through the auction world. So I was previously in a former life, I was a British art expert and auctioneer at Sotheby's. And I joined Sotheby's straight out of art school in the early 2000s. So, you know, I remember being a kind of junior lowly cataloguer in the pictures department at Sotheby's, and in came a piece of contemporary art on a piece of cardboard. It was a stencil, black and white stencil on a piece of cardboard, which turned out to be by the then unknown artist Banksy. And, you know, I remember, you know, my slightly older colleagues looking at this piece thinking like, what on earth is this? You know, it was so interesting to look back and feel like what they were looking at was just like another language. They just did not really understand it, even though they were kind of, you know, experienced paintings experts. There was just something different about graffiti and street art that when it started to come into, you know, the kind of mainstream, you know, off the streets and into the galleries, as it were, and it become something that people want to kind of buy and collect, that sort of changes, I suppose. And that piece that, you know, I saw in Sotheby's in the early 2000s was actually, I didn't realize it at the time, but it was the very first Banksy that actually got sold at auction back in 2005.
That's pretty cool, isn't it? That you got to see that.
Yeah, it was very cool. And I, you know, in terms of my own sort of personal journey, I didn't really appreciate that moment.
No.
At the time. It's only really in hindsight that's become a kind of thing that I'm quite proud of in a way. It was like, yeah. I was there at that birth of that sort of transition, because it was a transition.
Do you think Banksy is the turning point for it?
Well,
do you think he was
obviously
the artist?
Banksy gets a lot of the headlines because I think he did do something in those early, you know, in that early period, which was just different. And, you know, I think there are so many artists I'd love to talk about that are not Banksy, but like often all roads do sort of at some point during my kind of walks and conversations come back to Banksy because of my, you know, connection there, but also because he, you know, he was doing something funny and really bold and cheeky. And I loved the idea that like overnight you could just, you know, There was a period of a few years where kind of all the newspapers were just like hanging on every movement.
Mm.
And, you know, you'd wake up in the morning and there'd be a new Banksy in some pub in London or whatever. And people would flock to go and see it. And, you know, I got swept along with that. I thought that was really, you know, really interesting. So I suppose he kind of definitely helped turn people onto this new-ish art form. I say new-ish because to the people who do it, it's not new. Yeah. It's just what they do. But it became, yeah, probably about 20 years ago, became a thing that most people were sort of tuned into and were interested
in. Became a bit mainstream, yeah. Would you say that's your transition point when you got into sort of street art?
Yeah, the Banksy, you know, the Banksy piece was always something I look back on in my life and feel like, yeah, that was one of the defining moments of that. But another defining moment, when I left Sotheby's in 2010, I actually started a behind the scenes arts club, which I don't know if any of your listeners would have either been involved with or remember, but it was called Love Art London. And we did four pop-up behind the scenes events with artists, talks, conversations, studio visits, you know, going behind the scenes after dark to all sorts of museums and places that the public generally didn't have access to, but you know, we sort of leveraged our contacts and managed to get people in there, you know, for you know, ordinary people, you know, just young professionals or young people who just wanted to spend, you know, a 15 quid ticket price to do something special. And one of the things in the summer that actually our kind of community were requesting was something to do with street art walk, and I managed to find at that time, talking about art was something I was really comfortable with. I'd done it for a long time, but actually street art itself was not something that I knew much about at that time. So we had a tour guide that I knew and we worked with. But one day we were having and I remember it so clearly, we had a tour booked in that evening, and he called me at like, I don't know, 10 o'clock in the morning to say that he was ill and he couldn't do it. And that was a disaster because I just didn't want to let these 25 people down who, you know, signed up and were expecting something. Yeah. So I just told him that I was going to do it. So I said, right, give me your route. Give me the list of the artists that you're planning to talk about. I hopped on my bike, cycled over to Shoreditch, and probably within about 2 hours, I just, you know, got familiar with the content and I had some interesting thoughts on it myself based on my knowledge of art history. And I did the tour that evening, and you know, nobody realized that I wasn't the intended tour guide. So I thought, you know, from that moment I was like, well, why am I paying some other guy to do it when I can just do it myself? So that was when that happened. So that became a kind of mainstay, and then that sort of business morphed into over the years morphed into what I do now, which is I run a boutique events agency where we curate, you know, really interesting events for mostly a corporate audience, so kind of law firms and such like. But we do kind of quite interesting things of all scales, you know, ranging from kind of ballet performances at St. Paul's Cathedral down to, in the summer months, my connoisseurs walks. So they're street art walks, but I call them connoisseurs walks because we sort of go a little bit deeper. It sounds a bit pretentious, but it's not meant to be. You know, it's just the idea that we're kind of, you know, not your average street art tour group. We just want to kind of talk about the history of art and, you know, all sorts of interesting things. We talk about, you know, feminism and, you know, political protest and the origin, like we're talking about, like the origins of graffiti and street art and how it all comes together. And what you see, particularly relating to, I think, this conversation we're having, which fascinates me, is this sense of place and identity, I suppose. Not just, you know, identity has so many different threads, but, like, you know, street art is an expression of the artist's identity, but it's also an expression of the wall and the neighborhood's identity. I always think whenever I go to a city, whenever I go to a place, within reason, I always try and work out who's painting what on the walls, what they're trying to say. And you do get a really distinct vibe by looking at what's around you, actually just sort of positioning yourself in the urban landscape and just sort of absorbing it, just seeing what it's telling you, which is ultimately what the artists want, because they are communicating to you, whether you realize it or not, when you just sort of cycle past a beautiful mural or a piece of script or something. If you stop and look at it, they're actually trying to talk to you. So I really love that kind of dialogue that you can have with the urban environment.
I love it, street art, because it's just, if you think about it, it's free. You're just out in the street looking at beautiful pieces of art. You don't have to go to a gallery. And obviously sometimes they go. So it's that sort of limited time period that appeals as well, isn't it? So you really want to see it.
The transient nature of it, honestly, the transient nature of it is part of the appeal, you know, and that's why there's, you know, street art photographers and street art hunters are obsessive about, you know, finding out when a mural's being painted. Or, you know, I'm often regularly in, you know, in those parts of town, and I often smell a piece before I see it, and people think that's quite weird when I say that. But like, if I'm walking down a street and I can smell it in the air, and I'm like, ooh, where is that? And then I'll just, I don't know, literally follow my nose, and very often I'll find someone I know painting something that's awesome, and then I'm lucky enough to be the first person to kind of see it or photograph it. But yeah, like you say, sometimes it's gone. You know, all the artists that I know and work with have stories about, you know, their artworks. You know, there's one artist who, you know, told me recently that he was finishing a mural and there was literally a couple of artists waiting for him to finish it. He'd take his photograph and then they started painting over it. You know, that happens. But equally, there's a piece on Whitby Street in Shoreditch, which is by the Australian artist Jimmy C, which is one of my favourites. And I love Jimmy's work. And actually, Jimmy was one of the first artists that I really sort of fell in love with, you know, in that early 2000s period, because he was the first street artist that I saw and I was like, oh, I can obviously see your connection and your interest in the history of art. He's very interested in post-impressionist art. So, you know, particularly the work of George Seurat, his pointillist paintings. So like the kind of little dots that when you sort of stand back, they kind of form an image, but if you get up close, they don't. And he does a similar sort of thing with his spray cans. And there's a piece on Whitby Street, which has been there for, I think, 12 years now. You know, he's had done a couple of retouches. But I mean, you know, so it ranges from like, you know, decades to like minutes. You know, once you've finished a mural, it's sort of part of the appeal, I think.
Are these, would you say now, street artists, the walls that they paint on, it's allowed, or they're still just doing it and it's sort of, they just get away with it? I was thinking to myself as well, social media has kind of contributed a lot to it being seen as an art form, because they share it, you know, they're on social media, you can follow them. It doesn't seem as underground anymore. Mm-hmm. Like it's quite, look at what I've done and come and
definitely
see. So,
I mean, there's the whole rainbow exists, right? So I would say that generally in a place like Shoreditch, for example, which, you know, street art has become so much part of the furniture, it's just very common to see one or two or five artists painting a wall at once, you know. And in terms of the legalities of it, I would say that generally that's done with some kind of permission or nod, or in a place where there's a sort of designated area where it's permitted. But to be honest, even if it wasn't, I think in Shoreditch you probably get away with it because people just don't really bat an eyelid. Even the police, actually, like I've been doing street art workshops with artists where we've got some hilarious photos of this police walking past us and having a chat because they know what we do and it's not illegal. However, there's a whole community of artists or writers for whom the illegality of it is the buzz. That is what they do it for. So, like, obviously artists, writers who paint trains or places they're really not allowed to paint, they break into places and do that. You know, they're only doing that because the rush of it is part of what they, that's what they live for in a way. And that goes for like really well-known artists. I'm not going to name names, but I saw an artist a couple of years ago. I bumped into a really high profile artist who was painting a mural, and we were just sort of chewing the cud and having a chat. And he showed me that he had an electronic tag on his leg. And I was like, oh man, what have you been up to? And he's like, well, I got caught painting a train. And I was like, oh, but, and it sort of, to my mind, I was like, why are you doing that these days? Like, you don't need to do that. You're like, you kind of get commissions, like, five-figure commissions to paint your amazing pieces. He's like, yeah, but it's just the rush of it. I'm a compulsive train painter. Like I can't avoid it. And so, so I think there's something really sort of elemental for those artists or writers. You know, there are artists, for example, I say artists, they're absolutely not artists. They wouldn't identify as artists. It's a sort of force of habit to kind of say that. But then, they're writers, like, for example, 10 Foot, which may or may not be familiar to you and your listeners, but like if you, next time you're in an urban area, particularly in London, although I've seen his work all over the place, including like up a really steep hill in the middle of Dartmoor where I was in the summer. I was climbing up to for a swim, actually. I went for a swim in a dam. It's the Avon Dam in Dartmoor. It's the beginning of the River Avon, and I ran up the hill and I wanted to sort of have a little swim in the dam, and en route I found a piece by 10 Foot, and I was like, man, what are you doing in the middle of Dartmoor? Like, because
the last place you'd expect,
exactly, that. Because you drive through London or cycle through London, and on almost every bridge that I see is a piece by 10 Foot, or another artist who like Helch, for example, is a prolific graffiti writer. You'll see his, H's, it's one of those things. Once you see them, you can't unsee them. Like, you see them all the time, even if you've never noticed them before. I've said it to people, like, just have a look when you're driving around London for 10 Foot, and, you'll just see them everywhere. And I love the prolific nature of that. There was actually an article about him in the Financial Times. There was a 6-page spread, in March last year, I think. About him, because he's probably the most sort of notorious graffiti writer around, and certainly the most prolific. So, I think it was interesting, especially like for a kind of highbrow newspaper like the Financial Times to dedicate 6 pages to this, super kind of anonymous, illegal writer, was really remarkable. So definitely that I guess probably sits a little uncomfortably with him, maybe, because the whole point of those artists is that they are operating in the shadows, doing something that's, a bit naughty, and they don't really want to talk about it, and they certainly don't identify themselves. So to be sort of talked about in the mainstream probably is a double-edged sword for them, I reckon.
Yeah, that's what's funny about it, isn't it? It really is. I mean, let's talk a bit about some artists, actually. Who are some of your favourites? What style do you like?
I mean, for me, that is just like the hardest question in the world to answer. Yeah. I love them all. But I mean, I'm particularly interested in the history of art, as you know. So artists like, just off the top of my head, someone like Conor Harrington, amazing Irish artist, painting in a really unique old master painterly style. Is one of my favorites. But I love Jimmy C. His aerosol pointillist portraits are really, really striking, and I always love seeing them. Stick is always a pleasure to see. You see a little less of them these days on the streets, but some of the really famous ones that tend to be on some of the old studio spaces that he occupied are really, really great. I mean, you know, I love Shepard Fairey, for example, really, really interesting high-profile US street artist who is very political. You know, he's a classic example of a really political artist. You know, he studied at Rhode Island School of Art, and, you know, that in itself is an art school with a really interesting political history. Mm. I think it was the first art school in the US to allow women to study. It was also one of the first institutions, certainly the first art school, I think, in 2020 to come out in support of Black Lives Matter. And so his kind of, you know, political credentials were set. He's a, I think it's fair to say, a sort of a Democrat supporting US artist. So he produced obviously he's the father of the Obey movement. So Obey Giant, which some of your listeners may know, that actually is very interesting. That started in 1989 as an exercise in what he called phenomenology, which I think you're also interested in.
Yes.
Where he created a sticker campaign about, you know, with a eyes, nose and mouth kind of sort of silhouette, which was actually based on the face of the French-American wrestler Andre the Giant, which is where the Obey Giant thing comes from. But he put all these stickers all around, you know, skate parks and cafes and bars where, like, you know, young kids would kind of hang out on in America. And it became this, like, you know, pre-internet viral sensation where people were just, like, obsessed with this image. And fast forward 30-odd years and it's now a kind of, you know, a super famous kind of clothing brand, which I'm pretty sure was not his intention when he sort of created this, you know, thing when he was at art school. And he people who don't know that perhaps will certainly recognize whenever I show them the photograph of the Hope poster that was for Obama's 2008 campaign. Shepard designed that. So, you know, really interested in him. I really love the fact that certainly in London, and I think it's reflected internationally, there's a huge movement of women artists who are just absolutely smashing it, and, you know, not just leveling the playing field, but just like taking this, what probably was to some degree considered to be the pursuit of, like, you know, delinquent boys, probably, although that's a little unfair, because even if you kind of like look at the origins of, you know, graffiti in the States, you know, there are some significant women writers who actually often, you know, in a very funny way had like just very simple, like Eva 62 and Barbara 62 and Michelle, yeah. 60, you know, all these sort of like, but that's how it was, you know, back in the day. But so there were always women around, but like in the last, I'd say 10 years, I've just noticed on the streets of London, some really awesome female artists. Like there's a French artist called Zabou, broadly paints the most stunning black and white portraits around. You've got Mad C, who's called Claudia Wald, who's a German artist, but she, you know, paints these amazing kind of like abstract, brightly colored, just explosions of color on a wall. But she's very interesting because she actually cut her teeth as part of the Bandits crew, which was an early 90s graffiti crew, which I think is still together, maybe I'm wrong, but in the early 90s. And so her style, although it's abstract now, comes out of her obsession with wild style. Yeah, you've got artists like Rosie Woods, for example. Rosie just paints stunning, sort of very, sort of, I guess, a little psychedelic, swirly, abstract forms, which I really love. They sort of look like, I've often described them as looking a little bit like planets. You know, when you see kind of like photographs, really super high definition photographs from like the Hubble telescope of like certain planets in multicolor, they're just very swirly and beautiful iridescent pictures. So she, you know, paint, I think she lives in Australia now, which is a bit of a loss for London, but, you know, for a while she was around. Yeah, all sorts, really.
There's,
I mean,
so
I'm just,
many. There's so many.
Yeah, I mean, there's
that,
so
that
many.
That was one thing that I do love about your Instagram, because you're out and about showing new artists and things. It's hard to keep up, honestly, with the amount of artists that are out there. So it's lovely to see when you're skating around showing us what's out there.
Well, that's really kind. And I mean, I think that the Instagram that you talk about and the skating, certainly if people don't know that I roller skate or inline skate around Shoreditch with my live stream camera and my sort of podcast headset and talk about, you know, little snippets of interesting murals and stuff that I find. But that was born, you know, like some of the very best things in life, totally by accident and, you know, out of circumstance, because that was a real lockdown project. And it's often hard talking about lockdown, because lockdown for so many people was such a grim, sad, depressing time. But for some people, and I probably would put myself in this category, it offered an opportunity to kind of take stock it gave me time, even though, you know, my events business, which, you know, took a bit of a hit because, you know, if people can't physically get together, then, you know, it wasn't a great time to run any business, but let alone a business that involves people kind of coming together and sharing something. So I had a lot of time on my hands, and I probably had a frustration, and I wanted to do something that stimulated me, kind of connected me to the things I love. And so I used, even during those periods where you had an hour of exercise a day, I'd often just cycle to Shoreditch and use my hour of exercise to just talk about a piece of street art. Or actually what emerged was that some of my corporate clients would, you know, actually pay me to do a live stream tour of, you know, some street art, which was great because I was out on the streets at a time when no one else was allowed to be out on the streets. And certainly in those days, I remember some of my clients saying that, you know, what was really frustrating was you'd sort of buy a virtual tour from some person or some, you know, whatever. And actually what you would get would be them sitting at home in their bedroom sharing slides. And I'm not knocking that, because that, you know, that was what they were able to do. So they might have known a lot about, I don't know, things, but it was more like a webinar than a tour. So when my fully live stream tour on skates, you know, came along where 20, 30, 40 people could tune into a Zoom call and you'd stream live to me in London, and I'd give them an hour and a half of just, you know, my thoughts on street art, it was just one of those wild moments where people were like, oh my God, this is so great. I've missed the feeling of being out on the street. So that happened. And then, you know, I suppose alongside that, as a way of promoting it, I sort of did quite a lot on Instagram, but my Instagram audience and my actual kind of paying audience were very different. And I don't think we're particularly interested in each other. You know, Instagram just wanted its pound of flesh every week. They just wanted a 1 minute video every week. And that sort of blew up and was quite fun to do, but it didn't, you know, it didn't earn a penny from that. And then on the other hand, I had my corporate clients who would pay me, you know, and that definitely got me through lockdown financially.
Yeah.
To do live stream tours. And I still do them now, even though the world's been, you know, back out there for some time. I still do these live stream tours. I did one a couple of months ago for a group of clients who were in Hong Kong. So I'm on the ground in London at sort of 10 a.m. and they're just finishing their day's work at about 6 o'clock. And it's a really great way of getting a snapshot of something interesting in London without having to come all the way to London to see it.
It's such a good idea. So it's such a good idea at lockdown as well, because people were craving to be outside. That's like the closest thing, isn't it? Coming along with you, feeling like they're part of it. So yeah, no, props to you. Such a good idea. Really, really. And are you still doing, because I know you also do tours in person. Are you still doing that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I probably I'll do them all year round, to be honest. I don't give a hoot about whether it's raining or snowing or whatever, but probably, you know, it's reasonable to suggest that in, you know, let's say April to October, I do most of those. I did one last week actually for a group, you know, actually a family of friends who are visiting London from Holland, you know, had heard about me, and, you know, we did a 2 hour walk. So that was lovely. But I tend to focus my attention on my kind of, my corporate clients. So it's quite rare for me to do just public tours, as it were. But I do them from time to time.
Honestly, the Instagram stuff is great. I don't know if you'll keep doing it, but I've certainly really enjoyed it.
It's so funny. I do talk about this a lot, because I don't know if you find this, but when you have a kind of creative urge or an itch to scratch, you sort of get so into it and you do it quite hard for, like, I don't know, 6 months or a year. And it's quite hard to sustain that, especially as, like, when I was doing in the height of lockdown, I was possibly doing, you know, I was going out a couple of times a week and just doing maybe two videos a week. So the output was quite intense, but that's because I had a lot of time on my hands. And obviously in the last couple of years, my day job work has just again come back with an absolute bang. So I just don't have a huge amount of time these days. No. And it is frustrating, because sometimes, even, like, you know, to be honest, I was having a little look through my videos just in preparation for this chat. And I do always get like a nostalgic feeling. I was like, oh, I love doing those. I should do more. I should do some more. So I think something will come. But I also think that is the nature of creativity, actually. I think, like, it's never static. You know, it always morphs into something else. It always changes. I'll definitely do some other things, I'm sure. Because, like, right now I'm kind of fully engaged in doing my, you know, actually the walks with people. So, like, that's my sort of creative output in a way.
Hello, just a quick one from me. I'm really excited to tell you that I have teamed up with the Adventure Patch Company. So I'm actually feeling like a proper little podcast now. So the Adventure Patch Company is a small British business run by brothers Chris and Dom, and they sell patches, magnets, and pins, which all commemorate some of the UK's best-loved walking trails. Some examples of the patches they sell include the South Downs Way, the Pennine Way, the Thames Path, and so much more. They have got loads. They've got the Three Peaks. They've got, just honestly, do take a look. They've got a lot. So Dom and Chris themselves are keen hill walkers, and they felt that there wasn't really any quality patches out there on the market. So this is why they decided to create their own. And Chris, he designs the patches himself, and they just have such a lovely retro nostalgic feel, and they look a bit like beer pump badges. So just really creative and artistic and unique. I was actually gifted a patch after climbing Snowdon, and they're just such a lovely memento to have celebrating your achievement. And they're also just a fantastic gift for someone who loves hiking. Or if you're actually planning to go out on a hike with someone, you could buy one ready to give it to them at the end as a gift. Anyway, if you like the sound of this, because I do know a lot of the listeners, you're well into your walking, do go and check them out at theadventurepatch.co.uk. And they've really kindly given us a 20% discount if you type in the code SENSEOFPLACE, all in capitals, at checkout. That will get you 20% off. And I am going to be upfront, because we've connected and we're working together, I will get a small commission if you make a purchase. But I'm so happy to be working with these guys, because I just genuinely love their stuff. And I just feel like you guys would love it too. So I really hope you do. And anyway, I will let you get back to the episode now. Thanks for your time. The appeal of it, I mean, what is the appeal of graffiti to people, you know? Why do you think they do it? And also the sort of observers, what do you think the appeal is for people? I mean, I've said for me, I think mine is, I just love the vibrancy of it, that you're walking down the street, you've got, you know, because a lot of it, God, without it, you know, you've got dull grey buildings, haven't you, that just look awful.
Yeah.
They actually, I don't know if you know about this mural outside Southampton train station.
Describe it to me. That?
I think it's Narone. So it's supposed to absorb CO2.
Yeah.
And I just think, like, it's just reinvigorated the air so much. It just looks so nice when you come out of the station, you've got that. And again, it's interesting because it's also doing some good.
Yeah.
It's supposedly absorbing CO2. So it's sort of like a double element of goodness.
Yeah. There. I mean, I think you know, why people do it, or what it makes people feel, is really interesting. So I think you've got two sides there. You've got the artists and then the viewers, right? So I think from the artist's perspective, or the writer's perspective, they're doing it, like I've said, I think partly out of compulsion, because they, almost all the artists and writers I know, you know, are kind of, they remember just sketching from like the day they could hold a pen, you know, like they kind of got into kind of, I don't know, just copying comic books or all those sorts of things. And then that morphs into sort of, you know, writing your name, and then that becomes a tag, and then you kind of try and create your own style or your own font or your own sort of way of writing that name. And then once you've written on a page, it's like it's a logical progression. You're going to take a pen out and you're going to go and you, I don't know, you might be on a train and you like write it on a table as you leave, you know, all this sort of, and that's very much illegal activity and like, you know, vandalism, et cetera, et cetera. But that relates to like what you then see on a wall. It's all a progression. And, you know, I think they, artists and writers are simply expressing themselves, as artists have always done. So there's a compulsive element there. There's a self-expression. There's possibly an act of rebellion in there. There's just an outpouring of creative energy. You know, it's got to go somewhere. And, you know, you could argue that if it's not going from a spray can onto a wall, it could go in lots of other areas. That energy could take you in lots of other areas, both good and bad. So
no, you're right.
There are positives to it.
Yeah.
I also love the fact that, you know, street art and graffiti is by very nature democratic and not elitist. It is, it's on the street. It is literally, as you know, it is for the common man and woman. You know what I mean? It is literally for people. So, and the artists know that when they're producing it. That's one of the reasons why they do it. And so I think having that idea of what it makes people feel when they see it, when they walk past it, is really important, because, you know, there are lots of different sort of elements to that. You've got, like you've said, you know, a really beautiful mural can like really lift a street. It can really lift a community. If you've got a, if you've got an area where there are lots of beautiful murals, like it becomes a little open air gallery that people want to come to. They want to set up a coffee shop there. They want to kind of set up a little kind of clothes shop, or they want to like create something. The downside of that is that, you know, property developers often, you know, ride on the back of, you know, creatives and artists and people making areas cool and fun, and then the prices go up and the rents go up and people can't afford to be there, and all the only people who can afford to be there are the kind of, you know, the gentrified element of that, people with money, or, you know, big brands with like kind of can afford to pay the rent. You sort of, areas lose something and artists get pushed out, or like, but they'll go somewhere else, like they always have, they always will. So things change. I think, you know, ultimately it's for the people, really.
Yeah. What do you know, what one piece of art that really has always stuck with me was Bordello in Dublin. I don't know if you ever saw that.
He had a
giant piece of art, which was a squirrel. Yeah. And obviously he uses
like trash,
you know, bits of old junk. I just, that for me is just, wow, incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
And the sheer scale of them. I
completely agree.
Well.
I was in, because he's, I think he's, he's Portuguese. I think he's from Lisbon. So I was in Lisbon a couple of years ago, and there's a few really amazing, really amazing pieces, and even collaborative pieces that are just really stunning. I love his work.
Have you ever seen him like actually creating something? Because I
haven't in the flesh. No, I think that would be super cool.
Yeah, same. You just think, like, you know, when he's got like a bicycle or something within his artwork.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you just think, God, what a process to even.
Well, actually, talking about process, there's another Portuguese artist who I absolutely adore, and he's called Vils. And I saw some of his work. Well, there's some in London, but I saw some really amazing pieces in Lisbon. And I don't know if you know his work, but when I talked about like relief sculpture, so Vils' technique is fascinating. He basically either plasters a wall, or he takes a wall that is plastered, but he creates his image by attacking it with a pneumatic drill, like a handheld pneumatic drill.
I've literally just Googled him. That is incredible.
And when you see those like little videos of him at work, and you know, you see him and the close-ups of his drill kind of like cutting out little bits of the plaster of the wall, and then you scan back and you see an amazing face or something, you're like, oh my God, that is, that sort of style is just
the realism of it looks so good, doesn't it?
And I love that, like when you talked about Bordello, I can never pronounce
his name. I don't know if I pronounce it right. Bordello, I think.
I think it's, yeah, Bordello 2, isn't it?
There's
I think two. And also, you know, Vils, and also there's another artist, you know, who's a British artist who has a really unique style called Perspicier. And you see some of his pieces on Brick Lane, and they're like, they're made of thread. So his practice, again, if you kind of type Perspicier into Instagram and have a look at some of his videos, you'll see time lapses of him working. But broadly, he kind of, for argument's sake, we'll take a circular board and screw 200 or so, 250 screws in a circle, and he'll number each one. And he'll take an image and plug it into some kind of, you know, app that then spits that image out into a series of code, into sort of a numeric code. He'll then put that code into a text-to-audio app into his headphones, and he'll basically, I think, work a little bit like a 3D printer. So he'll be like listening to these numbers which correspond to a screw on the thing, and he'll take one single long piece of thread, and he'll hook the thread around whichever screw he's being told to hook it round, and gradually over the course of 2, 3, 4 hours you see a face or an image just sort of emerge, and it's an unbelievable style. And when you see them on the street, they're really like eerie and wonderful, but they're made of like, sometimes he uses like 6 kilometers worth of thread, you know, for one single piece, you know, like amazing stuff. And I made a little film about him. And when I first saw him, I didn't know him at the time. I said like, oh, what are you listening to? Cause I'm just interested in what artists listen to when they're making work. I'm interested in music as well. And he sort of looked at me a bit confused, as if like, you don't really know what I'm listening to, do you? And he put his headphones on me, and I couldn't believe it. He was just being shouted at like with loud numbers in sequence very quickly.
Wow.
And I could barely cope with it for about 10 seconds. And he listens to that for like 2 hours at a time. And that's how he makes his work. So I really love artists that just think so far outside of the box. They're just, you know, they're really doing something quite special, I think.
Yeah, the creativity is incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, another artist I like, which is obviously a bit more the classic style, is Dan Kitchener. I just absolutely love that. The night scenes, the light, just really, you almost can imagine yourself in that scene, can't you?
Totally. And I think it's interesting when you think about Dan Kitchener to remember that he worked in the movie, you know, business. He was like sort of making, you know, I guess installations and sort of like light, doing lighting and all sorts of interesting creative things with it within, you know, the movie world. So like, I often think that Dan has a sort of cinematic eye, you know, so like some
of his...
You're
right, actually. That's a really good description.
Yeah. So I think I love when you drill into an artist's background, it sort of makes sense as to the sort of work that they now make.
Yeah, completely. He's always, for me, just... I just love looking at his work. Don't know how he gets that vibrancy in it so well, you know, just, and like I say, you can really imagine yourself there.
Did you see the one he did recently? He did a really amazing one. I'd not seen one like it before, because obviously he either normally does the sort of Tokyo or New York or London sort of street scenes with, like, you know, cars and lights and umbrellas and people, or he does like very beautiful portraits of geishas, like, you know, Japanese geishas. But he did one on Commercial Road recently where it was just like looking through a windscreen of a car that was covered in raindrops. So he'd sort of somehow, you could see this scene in blurry, you know, behind, but actually what you were looking at were these incredibly reflective little raindrops all over the wall. It was absolutely unbelievable. So yeah, whatever he turns his hand to, I always think he's just an absolute legend.
Absolutely. Really, really amazing, isn't it? I don't know if there's anything else you sort of want to add to this to finish up. Got to get to work. So.
Okay, cool. I've had a really fun time.
Yeah, no, it's been amazing. Yeah.
You know, it's been a lovely chat. And, you know, there's 45 minutes isn't very much time to cover all this stuff. I could go on and on and on and on, but it's been a real pleasure to talk to you. And yeah, I'm really grateful.
Yeah, I'm sorry because I've got such a short window today.
No, it's cool. Thank you.
Where can people find you on social media?
For my graffiti stuff, House of Graffiti. So it's at House, like what you live in, of Graffiti. And you'll find me House of Graffiti on Instagram. That's probably the best place. I'm on Twitter, but that's not so much for my graffiti. That's more for my my events business. But if you want to find my events business, you can at Pensa, P-E-N-S-A, events with an S on Twitter. And if you find me on Instagram, on LinkedIn, you'll find me under my name.
So there we have it. I really hope you enjoyed today's episode with Chris. Go and check him out in the places he mentions. And for anything else Sense of Place podcast related, please head over to senseofplacepod.com. Other than that, that's all from me, and I will speak to you again soon.